I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. It's my very great joy today to welcome Mitali Perkins as the guest on Conversing. Mitali is a person that, to be fully honest, is a person that I've known since she was in graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley. And even before that, I had met her when she was a student at Stanford University. And in that season of time, she was studying at Stanford political science and at Berkeley public policy. But her life, let's just say, has taken perhaps a public policy theme in a surprising direction. And we're going to spend a lot of our conversation talking about her writing. She's written 10 very, very notable books for younger readers. It's really an amazing legacy, and it arises a lot out of her own story, which we're going to begin with. So, Mitali, it's just a great personal joy to me and an honor to have you on Conversing today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark. I love talking to you. Any excuse?
Well, this is an excuse that we've created because there's so much good stuff to be able to share about your story and about your work. So I want us to, let's start a little bit with your story. Some people who are listening to this probably are aware of your books, which include most recently just a few of the titles that some may have heard is You Bring the Distance Near, Tiger Boy, Open Mic, Bamboo People, Secret Keeper, Rickshaw Girl. These are all books that have landed in such a significant way and have gotten critical acclaim and been given significant awards. But before we get to that part of your life, let's go back to the Stanford Berkeley era. And often on my podcasts, I ask people to talk a little bit about their own spiritual background, and yours is particularly interesting. So why don't you just kind of sketch what that upbringing was in your home and then how the story unfolds from there?
Okay, well, that is an exciting story, one that I'll forever be grateful for. I was born in Kolkata, India, and my family immigrated here when I was 7, and I have two older sisters, as you know, Mark, Sonali, Rupali, and Mitali, and we all speak Bengali, so that's helpful. So I was the third girl born to a family that desperately wanted sons, as did most of the culture at that time in Kolkata, and so my mom was tired of people asking her, why didn't you provide a son for your husband? So she decided that it would be better for us to leave the country. So we traveled for a while in London and Ghana and Cameroon and settled in New York City when I was 7, and then moved to California, a suburb of in the East Bay, when I was 11 years old and I was in 7th grade. Now, Mark, you know that 7th grade is the year that if your life was a blockbuster movie, that's the year when the plot gets really thick and gnarly. Yeah, so I think we're all survivors of 7th grade. So in that school at that time, I was the only kid of color in the whole school, and I was the only one born not in the USA. So that's when I discovered the power of stories, because I had been reading all along. And looking back now, I think, how did I survive that time when I was so on the margins? And it was really the books I was reading, many of whom were written by Christian writers. Now, my family were Hindu, so I had no exposure to Christianity. I thought Santa was the Christmas was Santa, you know, and the fat guy came to gave presents to everyone else except us. And, you know, the Easter, all of a sudden a bunny came and did the same thing. I had no idea about the gospel. No one had ever told me the gospel. I didn't know anything about Jesus except that he was sort of the white man's person. And so I was going on like that. And then when I was 15, I had a very good friend who died in a car accident. He was hit by a drunk driver. And I had seen a lot of poverty and suffering through my whole life. This is one of my ongoing questions about God. But then it really became, you know, exponentially stronger as I lost my own friend to this sort of capricious accident. And I began asking questions about suffering and God. And my dad always taught us about a good creator. But when I asked him, Dad, how do we know God loves us? He really didn't know what to say, because he himself would point out how cruel it seemed to be born again and again and again back into this world of so much suffering and pain. And so I began seeking. And when I got to Stanford, I started reading like a crazy person about all the great works and the different religions. And it was my junior year when someone handed me a New Testament. And I thought, in fact, I had returned my Bible freshman year because it was an assigned book in humanities. And I thought, it didn't make any sense to me. People in the garden, apple, fruit, a serpent. I had no idea what that was. So I just thought, I'll get half the money back if I return my Bible to the bookstore. So I did. And then about 2 years later, someone gave me the New Testament and I began reading it. And I was really struck by how South Asian it was, how Middle Eastern it was, and how brown Jesus was. I couldn't believe how much at home I felt. And that was during the time where I was continuing to ask big questions of suffering and evil. And I was just reading through, much like one of the stories that I grew up reading, and I got to the part where he faces the cross. And that just completely blew my mind that the God who created the world would enter into it and allow people to kill him for the sake of the people that he loved. All of a sudden, that question of how can a good God allow suffering took on skin and flesh, and in my eyes, sort of brown skin and brown flesh. And so that's when I began to think, well, maybe I'll take Jesus as my guru. Mark, you know, I did not speak church. I had no idea what anything was. I visited my friend once, and the pastor said, you'll find the orders of worship in the narthex. And I thought, what the heck is a narthex?
What's an order of worship?
Yeah, exactly. But bit by bit, I just started following Jesus. I decided, okay, Dad has a guru. I'll take Jesus as my guru, and decided to get baptized in the fountain at, in the middle of the Stanford campus. And that was through Menlo Park Prez at the time. And after my baptism, it was like, I just wanted, so much joy just filled me. And I just began to learn more and more what it meant to follow this amazing man that is, you know, has now been my so-called guru for 35 plus years. So, and now I'm a pastor's wife. So I don't know how that happened.
Right.
kind of a crazy ending to that story.
Let's go back into the middle of the story and a part that I have heard you comment on that I want to share. There was a certain sense that the Hound of Heaven was really after you, and you were not really initially, for all the reasons you've just said, smitten by this cross-cultural experience of a Jesus that seems still like the white guy, and you go off to Vienna to a campus abroad. And there was a sense that I've often heard you express of just how unlikely it was that there were people that kept being surprising examples to you of a living faith that you couldn't easily discount. Now, have I gotten that wrong, or is that part of the story too?
No, that's absolutely right, Mark. Thanks for reminding me again that that was crucial. It wasn't just reading pages of a book. It was the people that I kept meeting. I kept having these encounters with people that loved Jesus and were seeking to live for him. And even in atheist Russia, when I went to a tour of the museum, the Hermitage Museum there, of course, the guy that took us on the tour was taking us around all this art about Jesus, and I was grappling with, who is this man? Who is Jesus? Is he telling the truth? And one of my favorite writers from back in the day when I was 4, 5, 7, 8 was C.S. Lewis. So I had read Mere Christianity as well. And that the museum tour guide took me aside at the end of the tour and said, you're really thinking about something, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I'm wondering if Jesus is really who he claimed to be. And this museum tour guide in atheist Russia said, you are at a point of intersection. God is calling you to move forward and know that. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I cannot get away from this. This is much more than intellectual. It was about encounter.
Right, right. Well, it's an amazing story. And to me, it's amazing because embedded in this for you was a jump across cultures, a jump across races, a jump across religions, a jump across geography in a certain way. And the jump isn't as big as you say, because Jesus is brown as well. But you know what I mean? When you start from the posture that you did at the beginning of thinking Jesus is this white guy, to understanding of Jesus as somebody who actually could inhabit a world that you knew about and shared with life and concerns for people at the margins, which is how you saw yourself.
Yeah.
That's an amazing pilgrimage to me.
Yeah, but I really love that he came and found me in the margins.
Yes.
Because I feel that he's kept me there, you know, so I call it maybe not a jump, but a squeeze between cultures, between, you know, between places of power and places of less power. And I really love being there. I feel like the encounters have continued to be so rich in that place that's in between. And even though it's not easy because I never feel at home anywhere, the good part is that with such a shepherd, you feel at home. You can make yourself at home everywhere, I guess, is what I've learned to enjoy that place very much.
One of the things that the psalmist says several times is that the Lord has set us in a broad place. And when I think about you and the years that I've known you and the work that you've done, it seems to me that one of the things that strikes me is that God's placing you in a broad place is part of what you're just describing. So on the one hand, you're a person who fully identifies and still to this day lives from the margins. But you also have a spirit that, from my point of view, is set in a very broad place of God's love, a capaciousness of care, creativity, imagination, humanity, empathy. That's really quite amazing, Mitali. I think it's one of the marks of the Spirit of God in your life for me. How do you understand that? I mean, you know, in a way you had this marginalized background, but in another way, you also had a privileged background, right? And
yes.
In that privileged background, you felt and were at the margins. I hear that loud and clear. But in other terms, we'd say you had a really privileged background. You went to very privileged schools. Mm-hmm. You earned remarkable degrees. You had access to a world that could have, as it were, gotten you away from the margins. And what's fascinating to me about your own instincts are that you chose not to move in that direction. You chose to, even through your writing, which we're going to come to in a minute, even more deeply explore what the margins are really about. How do you understand that or narrate that? Maybe I've miscast it. How do you see it?
Yes, I think two stories. One is that when I was born as that third daughter, the part I didn't tell you is that I was actually, this is my celebrity moment, Mark. When
yes.
I was born, I made headlines because I was the fattest baby ever born in that hospital. I was huge. I was late. I was hearty and healthy. And so I started life out very privileged.
Vigorously.
In the sense of
yes.
my vigor and my health.
Yes.
And yes. And so I've always thought about that. You know, there's been this growing desire to serve people. Like when I applied to graduate school, I wrote that my essay was about that there's this desire to serve babies that didn't start out life like that
mm-hmm.
with so much strength and health. And the other story I always think of is I spent a year of grad school in Kolkata back there studying literacy among the slums.
Yes.
And they have these rickety buses, as you know, from traveling in India. And in Kolkata, they have ladies sections of the buses.
I see.
And so, you know, I'm tall and I don't know what happened to me, Mark. I'm like an aberration of my culture, but I'm this tall, big, strong Bengali woman from start to finish. And the bus would be going over potholes and I would reach up and grab the bar. And then within about 2 seconds, there were about six pairs of little Bengali women's hands that were clutching my arm and holding on
Amazing.
To me.
Yes, yes.
And I would just hold on for dear life and they would hold on to me and we would have these incredible moments of closeness as we all held on. And I always think about that's really privilege. That's what privilege is given to us for. And I think that was formed from the books I was reading as a child. Mm-hmm. I look back now at books like The Little Princess or Little Women, and those books, I would read them and read them again and read them again, and they went so deep into my heart. I give a lot of credit to my spiritual mothers and fathers in those books.
Mm-hmm. So how did the journey from public policy at Stanford lead you to eventually write books for young readers? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a tough question because, you know, your parents come, they sacrifice so much. As you know, my parents started out life in the villages of Bangladesh. They lost everything in the war, started from scratch here. And really, our education was so important to them. So they put you through these schools and they sacrifice. And then you say, hey, Mom and Dad, I'm going to write children's books. Isn't that a great idea? Yeah, I always say there were three choices, engineer, doctor, and engineer. Those were our choices.
Yes.
But my parents, I think they raised us with so much poetry and literature in our home, Bengali and English, that it wasn't surprising to them. I did have a moment in my late 20s where I had to decide vocation because I had a job opportunity to work at Santa Monica City to try to, with my public policy degree, to focus on the homeless. And that was a dream come true job for me. And then I also was teaching poverty in the third world at Pepperdine as a visiting professor. And so I was considering getting more and getting my doctorate. I loved teaching. And then I had this thing about children's books. And I was like, what is going on with that? So I went away to Sarah Retreat, which is in the hills. I hope it's still standing.
It is.
I don't know
if it's still there.
Fires, yep. But I went up there and I just sought a day of intentionally seeking God and saying, what is this? What should I do next? And so I was going back and forth. I went down to this musty old library. And Mark, I know this doesn't usually happen to me. I don't have these, you know, zapping mystical encounters, but I was just sort of not getting any clarity. And I reached back, pulled out a book from this bookshelf, and it was an old book written by a long dead person. And it was titled The Spiritual Vocation of Writing for Children. And I started reading this book and I started to sense this feeling of excitement and realizing that is what I wanted to do. I really, if I look deep down inside my heart, I believed that books for children had shaped my heart to care for the poor, to love the people on the margins, and really to love Jesus in the long run. And I thought, that's what I want to do. So that's when I said, okay, let's go. And that's when I started writing and getting my years of rejections after that.
Well, those days now seem long past, but we can come back to the rejection season, which I'm sure probably every author can talk about. But you're certainly not in a season of rejections now. I mean, as you began to actually do this and began to feel like your craft was really growing, what began to emerge for you as a writer? And why young readers? I'm assuming it's partly out of your own story and even that book that you just said you happened to encounter.
Yeah, I don't know if you reread books from your childhood,
sure.
But I never stopped rereading those. I reread them seasonally.
Yes.
So you know, around now, I'll do the whole Narnia series, and I'll do the Lord of the Rings, and I'll go to Little Princess and all the Louisa May Alcott books, and then I have this whole seasonal rereading thing. Well, here I was at Stanford, finals exam week, and everyone's studying so hard, and I'm sneaking out of the Stanford campus, going over to the public library in Palo Alto, and finding an old copy of Secret Garden or something, and just de-stressing by reading that book.
Yes.
So, and again, even when I read those books, I see how there's so much beauty and truth. I don't know if you've ever read Heidi, for example, but Heidi has that parable of the prodigal son at the heart of that story. And if you read it and read it again and read it again, it just sort of immerses your heart in that parable. And I think that that's definitely why I also my voice, my writer voice is about age 14 at the tops. That's definitely what I was designed to do. And I love just kids and I. Adults are way overrated, Mark. They're overrated.
Whoever thought it was a good idea to be an adult was slightly crazy. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that the tenderness of your story, I mean, I know that in longer conversations that we've had, there were acute pain points for you as a kid that made a deep imprint on you that seemed to me to be a part of the rich legacy and empathy that sets you up to be such a sensitive narrator in writing that really, by definition, I think it's fair to say that all of your books are about cross-cultural life and experience and collisions and mystifications and malfunctions and hopes and yearnings. I mean, is that not true? Is that a fair way of describing it?
Absolutely true. I talk about those middle school years. Those were hard years when, you know, I think I've shared with you some stories about some cruelties that we all suffer during those years, as I said before. But when I look back, I was pretty strong and sturdy, Mark. I ran for student body treasurer or something by eighth grade. I mean, I lost, but I ran.
Right.
I played tennis. I had a very sturdy sense of self.
Right.
Despite all that, and I really attribute that to the stories I was steadily consuming mm-hmm. through those years, because mm-hmm. those were all heroes' journeys. Those were all people who overcame obstacles, and I was also learning how to do that code-switching dance from what I was reading.
Yes.
Now, our home, as you visited our home, so you know, it's traditional village Bengali. It still is my parents' home. And at school, you know, I was California suburban, you know, I was using my curling iron to try to flip my hair back every day. And so I'd learned to do that code switching dance where you can figure out all the clues, the power clues in different settings very quickly. Now, when you learn that as a child, it really does last you a lifetime, a little bit of it, because children are so quick to learn the nonverbals and verbals, language and accent, everything.
Right.
And so because I acquired code switching proficiency, I think once you survive it, it's a huge advantage over monocultural people, because you can go anywhere and you can use that to make people feel loved, to make yourself feel at home, to create, like you said, that broad space. I think that's where that comes from, mm-hmm. is this capacity I gained during those painful years.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing. I think that you've said enough that probably most people know what you mean by code switching. I know what you mean, but I think it might be helpful if you could just give some examples so every listener is aware of what you're really getting at.
Well, yeah, when I talk to students who are, I call living the hyphenated life, you know, yes. that whatever your hyphen is, some people get to lose it after a few generations. Some of us keep it. There's all kinds of things. You know, we come home from school, you take your shoes off, your dad asks you how we did at school. You have to report in. Just like take dating, for example. You know, the first time one of my older sisters got invited out on a date, my dad said, oh, dates, that's what, you know, those are the fruits I used to climb trees and eat those. He didn't even know what that was. Yes. My parents had an arranged marriage. So you date after you get married, not before you're married. So, yes. you know, dating was not allowed in the Bose home for the Bose girls. I'm not saying it didn't happen, Mark. It just, we found our ways to, you know, keep dad in bliss.
Code switching.
Thinking it wasn't yes. happening. So that's, you know, all that balancing of two worlds, there's different manners. You know, we didn't eat with utensils. I'd go to some Americans' homes and there would be two forks and two knives. We're eating with our right hand only at home.
Right.
So everything's different. Manners, clothes, food, the way you treat your elders, everything. And so you have to learn to be proficient in both.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So take us into some of your writing. I mean, I think the thing that almost all of the awards that you've received seem to indicate are several things, and maybe you can just gather these up in your own reflections. But, you know, people often say about your writing that it has a unique capacity to create living characters that children and young readers can readily identify with and hear their own voice in the story that experiences a great sense of empathy, a great sense of vividness of description and of dialogue. A capacity to tell the story, the whole narrative arc is one that draws people into a story that really matters emotionally and mentally. It's often a layered story because of the multiculturalism that you're often dealing with. What would you say in response to those things? Are those things that you're consciously intending, or do you see it really more from a different starting point?
Well, you've written books, Mark. You know, you look at your own books and you think they're like, you know, children. You look at them and you love them all, but then you think, oh, they all drive you crazy. So thank you for your kind words about the craft, because it's always something I seek to improve. And I see all my flaws all the time when I see my work. But having said that, I do try to create characters that when a young reader is encountering that character, can imagine life in that person's skin. So I have two kinds of books. One is reflecting that hyphenated experience.
Right.
Those are more my older books that people read all the way through high school and even into adulthood. And then there's the books that are fully set overseas that have no Western characters, that are dealing with issues like refugees or child soldiers or microcredit or climate change. Those are my global books.
Yes.
And those are for younger readers. So
right.
I have two kinds of books that I love to write. Mm-hmm. For a long time, the global books were rejected because they didn't have any what I call bridge characters.
Uh-huh.
I didn't name that. That's a common way to describe an American character that is created, sort of like Julia Roberts in Eat, Pray, Love, or
yes.
who goes because the reader is it's too far to travel was the thought for a Western reader to travel so far to another culture and have no character that they can imagine themselves in, more akin to them. Well, I find that to be totally ridiculous, especially for children. Children travel so widely and freely. So those are my best-selling books, those that have no American characters. And children, I get letters from all over of the world in rural Iowa where there's, I don't think there's any Bengalis, and someone will say, oh, Naima is my best friend now. I love her.
Or, so you know, wonderful. So
I just love how children will just throw doors open and in their imagination in ways that adults tend to be a little more hesitant
yeah,
to do.
Yeah. When you talk about the global books, let's go there for starters. What are the issues? You mentioned a few of them, but when you think about what you're trying to lift up in that context, what are the things that are the burdens that I suppose you're trying to carry through in the narratives that you're trying to write?
Well, it's tough because I'm still, even though I was born in Kolkata and I'm Bengali, like, for example, Rickshaw Girl, which is really about the fact that women in rural Bangladesh for years did not have economic power, could not make money.
Right.
And this is a book I'm writing for fourth, maybe third, fourth, fifth grade.
Right.
And so for a Western reader, they think, wow, this place is so unfair, it's unjust. And yet I'm trying to reflect also that, for example, how elderly people are treated in Western culture, seen through Bangladeshi eyes, is appalling and unjust. You know, every culture has its flaws and has its need for restoration or redemption. So I'm trying really hard not to be too reverential and yet to have hope that is valid within that culture, that isn't Western, maybe a Western hope for a Bangladeshi Muslim girl.
Right.
So that's always really a tricky dance. But the best compliment for Rickshaw Girl is that it was, I know you know this, but it's so exciting to me. I just got back from Bangladesh because it is being actually adapted into a movie there by a Bangladeshi Muslim screenwriter who wrote it and a director, producer, actor. So they're all taking that story that I created when I was sitting by my fire in Boston
right,
and putting it on the screen. So for me, that's such a high compliment because I strove so hard to walk that balance.
Right, right.
Of authenticity.
So yeah, then they wouldn't be taking it up had you not succeeded at doing that. So since you mentioned that, I was going to come to that in a minute, but since you just mentioned it, let's go down that road for just a minute.
Okay.
So now a whole new chapter of Mitali Perkins is opening up as the writer of stage, screen, and books. So tell us about that. What is it like to see a product that you wrote in your own imagination and now suddenly seeing it manifesting itself as it's unfolding in a film?
Well, I'm usually kind of a curmudgeon about adaptations because I really love, like, when I read a book that I love, I've never, like, enjoyed one of the Little Women movies. I forget that. So I get really ornery about adaptations. But as I said before, because it's being taken by such culturally sheer hands,
yes,
in this case with the Rickshaw Girl, I'm so thrilled. The book was written years ago, Mark, and then it was recently made into a play, as you said,
yes,
here in San Francisco, Berkeley. It was the Bay Area Children's Theater. And so they put it on. My mom and I went, and it's the story of a girl who decides to try to drive her dad's rickshaw.
Yes.
And at one point of the story, she crashes the rickshaw. So my mother and I are in the darkened theater watching this unfold. And all of a sudden, the rickshaw crashes. And we clutch each other and we gasp and we say, oh, no, what's going to happen next? And then my mom looks at me and says, you wrote the book. I had totally forgotten. It had been so long. And it was being adapted so beautifully by all these talented South Asian actors. And they just added, it was like going from 1D to 3D, and it was just a miracle to see it, like, with their voices and their bodies,
yes,
giving flesh to my character. So I had forgotten I wrote the book. So probably when I watch the movie, it'll be the same thing. What? What's going to happen next?
Right. But you did, when you were there, I think, get to meet some of the people who were actually in the acting roles of the book, right?
I did. The American Embassy actually arranged this lovely panel where the director of the movie, who's this very wonderful director, very well known in Bangladesh, has tons of fans there, Amitav Reza Chowdhury. And then the lead actor, Navera Rahman, we were on the same panel. And I kept looking over at Navera, who's going to play my character, Naima. And I just couldn't believe that there was my character sitting right next to me.
Yeah, that's
she was beautiful. She's so cute, Mark. She's adorable. So I'm just thrilled. It was wonderful to meet them all.
Is the movie going to come out in English eventually, or?
It's going to be all English. They decided they wanted to, it's going to be in English and then dubbed into Bengali.
Oh,
I just yesterday I talked to the producer and He told me that was their decision. They want to submit it as the entry. Their dream is to submit it as the entry to the Academy from the Bangladesh foreign film.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh, Mitali. That's so great.
Yeah, so, yeah, Rob's already, you know, deciding what tux to wear. But yes. I'm like, hold on, honey. Hold on.
Well, that's a really, that's a wonderful
really
step.
Really fun. Really
yeah,
fun.
Really, really fun. I think it's an example, though, when things are turned from books into films, I think there's something imaginative that has caught people's attention that causes them to think this needs to be seen and heard and felt in a 3D form in a way that hopefully complements and doesn't undermine the book, which it sounds like you're feeling this does.
Yeah, so I think so. And the story is really about a father who says that a daughter is as good as a son. And even that came right out of my life. My father championed his daughters like you wouldn't believe. You know, you met him.
Yes.
So I think that's what's resonating is that thread in that story, that idea that a father can really embrace and welcome a girl child in that culture, which for so long has looked down on girl children. So I think that's what they're responding to, and that's what's probably going to be in the movie. I know it is going to be. That thread is going to be in there. So exciting.
Yeah, one of the things that was so amazing about your dad and your mom, really, was that, as you said, they could admit culturally they were wanting sons rather than daughters, but then they got these three unbelievably gifted daughters who they realized were unbelievably gifted. And they did everything possible to help all three of you to really thrive. And certainly by the time I came into your family story, those earlier days had passed. I'm sure the residue of that might linger from time to time, but fundamentally, they were nothing but your cheerleaders on the side of helping each of you be the unique people that you were, exercising your gifts, your intelligence, your authority, your power. I mean, I really, Janet, my wife and I used to joke that really the Bose family was being raised to dominate the world. I mean, that really all, that these three women were going to soon control everything. At least that was the image that we got from your parents. They were so utterly confident and believing in each of you and in your capacities.
Yes. Oh, yes. Such a gift. And really, you know, I wrote that one of my most recent novel, You Bring the Distant Near, is about three generations. And the first generation, I think, is the most heroic, my parents' generation. And yes. I saw it lived out. They lost everything in the war, sacrificed everything. Someone has this theory that immigrants who come here are really the best of the best, the first generation that comes, because they're the ones that have the courage and can take the risk and can see that long story and can do it, you know, united together as husband and wife. There's definitely truth in that in my own. As I look at my parents to me are heroes for sure. So, yeah, but I still remember, though, when my mom, you know, she wanted to get out of South Asia because she kept hearing about the sun thing. And then when I took high school biology and I came home and explained to her about the X and the Y chromosome, I remember my mom saying, "Oh, it's your daddy's fault." She was so excited. So yeah, a lot of that village stuff, you know, my mom left that behind. She's very happy. She's a patriotic American now. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
And I put that in the book, You Bring the Distant Near. My mom became a fierce patriot, American patriot, as the older woman in the book. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing story in its own right. One of the things that strikes me, Mitali, is that you're such a multicultural person in so many different ways, in the classic forms of culture, but also overlaying all of those multicultural instincts and the code shifting that you've been able to do and so forth, mm-hmm. is also the way that that intersects with your faith. So when I think about the settings that I've seen you in when you've been doing book readings in a highly mixed audience of people who probably in most cases have little or no affinity or connection to the Christian faith, or necessarily with any other faith, but they are drawn to you, they're drawn to your writing, their children have been enamored, or they themselves have been enamored of your writing. And when I've listened to you at book readings do what you do, you flow so unselfconsciously through all of the various languages that you speak, if you want to put it in those terms. And all of it has the same ring of authenticity and integrity. Was that hard for you to achieve that, or is that how you experience it, or is that just how it seems to those of us who have the pleasure of watching you in that setting?
Oh, Mark, you're so kind. You're going to get me all choked up. I think it's because I didn't grow up in the church, so I never spoke church.
Yes.
That I never really learned all that stuff, how to be churchy. I'm not good at that. So I think that was really a help to me. And the other part of it, I like to encourage younger writers who are people of faith, or not even people who are striving to serve the world with their writing, that there's really two reins to hold very strongly in your hand. One is the career, and that means being professional, being excellent, doing, you know, just really striving for craft and to have a good reputation in the field as a person of excellence. But the other is the vocation, and that, in the old sense of the word, that going back to that musty old book I found in that Sarah Retreat library, and that's always still about encounter. It's always about Jesus bringing people, usually from the margins, to you, and for you to be able to reflect back Jesus' love to that person. I've seen that all throughout. I traveled, just got back from 10 weeks in 10 states and 3 countries, doing a lot of those book talks. And it's, you know, on social media, it seems like, oh, this glam career. But in the resonance of it, it's about these people you meet that you know Jesus is bringing to you. As a quick example, I was judged the National Book Awards. So I was there for that, which was so fun. Big event, huge, like top of the publishing world. And I was a judge. But then I went to receive my own South Asia Book Award in Houston. I was supposed to go. And this is a small little ceremony, very homey. So it was snowed out. It was snowed in. I couldn't get, every flight was canceled. Hmm. And so I just thought, well, I'm going to go home. I'm so tired. But then by some miracle, the gate agent said, oh, one seat's opened up. So I figured, okay, I think God wants me to go to Houston. So I get there. My books didn't arrive. So there's no signing for me. So career-wise, it was a total flop. But as I walked into the event arena, I see a friend of mine that I've known for years now in the book world, and she just recently lost her husband. And as we're walking toward each other, her face just sort of, you know, that grief overcame her face. And as we got closer, I could see tears start to flow, and then she began to cry hard. And I didn't say anything. I just held her, and we stood together and cried together. And that, to me, I felt was the reason I had to go to Houston. It was that 5 minutes
right.
of this deep, sweet encounter with who else but a widow. You know, if you look at who Jesus always preferred, you know, widows, orphans, alien strangers. And that's often in my traveling, I see that. So I think it's because I felt like such an outsider that, and because Jesus drew me in from so far away, I think the encounters in the vocation are so precious to me through all the traveling and the book talks and the glam of the career and the hard knocks of the career, which is more like it. You know, you get a lot of rejections and bad reviews and all that stuff, but the vocation and the encounters with Jesus just sustain you through the years. So that's what I would wish for younger writers to have in their journeys.
One of the things that impresses me about what I've been following, especially through social media, are these various libraries and schools where you appear as a featured writer and children know you. I need to tell the story that I was in the Midwest with a family that I greatly love, and they have 4 avid reading children, and I hadn't thought about whether they knew you or knew your books. And I suddenly realized that maybe they had encountered your books. So I said, oh, I wonder if you know a good friend of mine who's also a writer. Maybe you've even read some of her books, Mitali Perkins. And I can't even begin to adequately express the unbelievable enthusiasm of these 4 children who all said, Mitali Perkins. So what I'm getting at there is not just their enthusiasm, which was great, but it was the feeling that you had landed in their life. The books that you had written had landed for them. And that's why you mattered, because the characters that you'd created, the stories that you'd told had really landed. And when I watch what I've been able to pick up on of your book readings and your appearances at schools and libraries is also not just connections like in the instance you just gave with an adult, but also these very tender, vulnerable, enthusiastic children who hear. So tell us a little bit about that part of your work.
Oh my goodness. I really do feel sorry for people who write for adults because, you know, like I said, the reception that kids give you, it's no accident that Jesus said, be like a child, because the hospitality you get from kids, their openness to travel with you. When I tell stories about my dad, I visit schools all over the world. And I tell stories about my dad, about how if I, you know, his hospitality, he would stand at the door with his arms wide open and say, come in. And,
yes.
And I get letters from kids later on, and they say, I could picture your dad throwing his arms open to me. And they're just so open to my life, my family. And again, I always, as I said before, adults overrated. As soon as they enter the room, I get a little more stiff. When I've got just kids around me, it's just so much. They're so eager to know what your hero's journey is, because they're really seeking their own. They're starting their own.
Right.
So yeah, I always really do appreciate my time with those kids. And you talked about my dad. Well, as you know, we lost my dad about a year and a half ago, and I was about to go on book tour, and I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? Really, it was only through that idea that Jesus was going with me. And you bring the distant near. The father is much like my dad, very much like my dad. So I went to this school in Kalamazoo, about 300 eighth graders, and they had all, I didn't know that they had all read the book. I had no idea. I did this talk. And then afterwards, I said, any questions? And so, spoiler alert, in this book, For You Bring the Distant Near, the dad is not in the later part of the book. And so this little boy, it was a Title I school, lots of refugees, lots of immigrant kids. He raised his hands and he said, I miss the dad in the last half of the book. I really wish you hadn't taken him out of the book. And I was just so missing my dad. And so I, of course, you know, since I cry all the time anyway, I started getting teary in front of 300 eighth graders. And Mark, I cannot tell you, the love that flowed from their eyes and face to me was just incredible. Hmm. There was this holy silence as, you know, we sort of all grieve my dad together. And that is what I get from kids, I think, that is astounding to me, the way that Jesus shows up through kids to me. Yeah, that's just one of a thousand examples where I get to be with kids. I'm sorry for you that you have to be with seminary students.
Exactly.
But you know what? We're all kids in the core. So I think that's the advantage. As you said before, I really can see the kid in people, and because I'm sort of stuck at that age myself. So it's fun.
Mitali, this conversation could go on a lot longer because there's so much about your life that I have admired and been touched by and changed by, really, in ways that have lasted with me over all the decades that we've known one another. But I just have to say that what I love most is actually those book readings where I've seen you stand at the intersection of so many colliding stories, backgrounds, people, circumstances, in the integrity of your own writing, the integrity of your own life, and your readiness to live honestly and vulnerably, as you've just demonstrated, with that whole story right in front of you all the time. And that is just an amazing form of grace. So thank you for this conversation, and thank you for the writing that you're doing that's changing kids' lives and adults' lives as well. And I, just as a friend, I'm certainly proud and delighted and thrilled with how it is that your talents are being used. And I can't wait to see Rickshaw Girl when it comes out. And and many of your books have had such significance for me. So thank you for the gifts that you're giving all of us, and for your call, and for the work that you're doing that is touching lives.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me. I used to apologize for my tears, but now I don't anymore, because my dad cried quickly, and I think it's kind of my Bengali gift to the Western world is
yes.
This easy tears. So
yes.
There you go.
There
Thank
we
you
go.
So much for having me, Mark. I love talking to
of
you.
Course.
Hope to see you soon in the Bay
I do
Area.
Too. Thanks so much. You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.